I've not met her for quite a number of years now. 7 years, more than 7 years. And I only know of her evolution through very rare letters. I am faulty. I should have answered her last letter, and owing to many reasons, owing to, first of all, to the fact that writing is difficult for me with my poor eyes, I have not yet replied. I'm going to reply for the winter solstice. She's interested in occult things, and she would like to have an occult background, that is to say, a background of experience of, I wouldn't say yoga, but the equivalent of it, to strengthen not her belief in National Socialism, but her efficiency in supporting it. Of course, if one has yogic powers, if one has developed yogic powers, one is stronger. But I don't know exactly what way she's following. She told me she was following a way that was difficult but quick. I don't know enough about it, enough about what she's doing, what she's following. Who is he? Who is the man or the person who is helping her to give an opinion? I'd have to know all that, and I don't know a word about it. The only thing I can say is that she did a few rash things in Paris and had herself put to jail. She put up with jail very bravely. She was again in jail in England, accused of having ordered two members of the NSM of having set fire to a synagogue, which was not the case. She never gave any such order. And she was asked in her trial, why did you give that order? She said she didn't give it. And she was asked, do you approve of setting fire to synagogues? If she had answered, I don't approve of it at all, she would have got away with it. Or she would have had perhaps a month imprisonment. She had, in fact, something like 2 years. And she had these 2 years for the boldness of her answer. I had given her a piece of information. I had told her that, and I think the page 84 or so, maybe before that, of Hans Grimm, Warum, Woher, Aber, Wohin, that book of Hans Grimm, it is said that the Führer himself did not approve of the pogrom of the night of the 9th of November 1938. It was organized, rather supported by Goebbels on his own account, without the knowledge of the Führer at all. It was a movement whose real root was the indignation of the German people, because two, at least, prominent Germans, Gustloff and von Rath, were killed by two Jews, the last one being the famous Greenspan. And it was a reaction to that. Well, just as there was a reaction in 1905 in my own native town, in Lyon, in France, because the President of the Republic, Mr. Carnot, happened to be killed there by an Italian. The Italian quarter was wrecked and ruined. People even hurt, they tortured Italian pigs belonging to Italians, that is to say. Well, stupid thing to do and an awful thing to do. They were not the cause of that thing. The same thing, minus torture to animals. The same thing happened in Germany. People were indignant. But the Führer did not approve of it. He told Goebbels the next day, you have set my work back for years and perhaps broken it entirely with your stupid nonsense. Stupid nonsense, why? Because this will give a bad name to Germany in foreign land. And we don't need that bad name now. We need to go forth without any complications. Why do you create trouble? So, that's what the Führer said. I told Francois, That was that. And she remembered it. She remembered the quotation of Hans Grimm also, the page of the book. And she have applied to the judge in front of everybody. Well, I cannot approve of the burning of synagogues and such kind of things, because the Führer did not. And I cannot approve of anything which he does not approve of. And I know he did not approve of it because it's written in Hans Grimm's German book, Warum, Woher, Wohin, page so-and-so. She got that information from me. In fact, I myself, in Germany, was asked in 1955, I was asked what I think about the pogrom. And I told them, well, I used to approve of it until last year, 1954. I said, what? They said, 1954, you got better knowledge, better sense, and now you understand that it's wrong. I said, not at all. In 1954, the book of Hans Grimm, Warum, Woher, Wohin, appeared, and I read it. And in that book, I saw that the Führer did not approve of it. Therefore, I cannot approve of a thing that he disapproves of. That's the only reason why I don't approve of it. Because in the time, in 1938, I was in North Bengal at Jalpaiguri, preaching for the Hindu mission, that is to say, preaching in the name of the Hindu mission that I was working for, against all ideologies of equality, communism, well, any religion of equality, any religion that accepts equality and mixture of races, and communism. And when I heard of the pogrom, well, I said, all right, good for them. They did some damage to some Jewish shops, and what that, what for that? Doesn't make any difference. But now I know the Führer was against it, I'm naturally against it. That answer, I mean, say, angered the people I was talking to in Germany, people that were not National Socialists, more than if I had said, I approve of it, even more. So I can understand the reaction of the judge in François Dior's case. He gave her 2 years, and she put up with it, and she scrubbed the floor in the prison. She was made to do the most heavy work, and she did it joyfully. People, I would say, insulted her. People had made her have a very bad time, and she said, I don't mind at all. I'm doing this for my Führer, and I like that. I told her, Françoise, I'm proud of you, when she told me about her imprisoning. Now, I cannot say more about her, because I have not been in touch with her for many years. But she was sincere, she is sincere, I think. And even if she does not always understand all the implications of National Socialism, well, who does? It's no business of mine. My business is to try to be a good National Socialist myself, and not to criticize anybody. About the dealings, I mean, say, between François Dior, Jordan and Tyndall, it's better to ask Tyndall himself, or Colin Jordan. It's no business of mine at all. And I only regret that whatever happened might have contributed to the breaking up of the NSM. And I deplore that very, very greatly. But I think that if the people in the NSM had been a little more attached to the ideology, whatever may happen on the private, in the private sector, could not influence the attitude, and they could have stayed together all the same. There was no business, there was no reason of falling apart between Jordan and Tyndall. I would have stayed apart, stayed together. Now, Tyndall is now heading the National Front in Britain. I'm very glad of that. I'm very glad the National Front is against entry of more and more and more, either complete non-Aryans or mongrels. I don't know whether it's true. Colin Jordan wrote to me lately. I did not answer his letter. I don't know how far it's true. Telling me that Tyndall accepts membership of Jews into the National Front, if they are English Jews, of course. I don't know whether that's true or not. And therefore, I'm not repeating. I'm just saying that Jordan wrote to me to tell me that. I did not reply to him. I don't know what to say. I'm not on the spot. And I don't wish to judge. I hope it's not true. I hope it's a mistake. I hope it's a mistake. I mean, it's a misinformation. I'm not any gesture of Jordan purposely directed against Tyndall. I hope that the differences, the falling apart is a thing of the past completely. Now, whatever it is, anything that can contribute to the stopping of the inrush of non-Aryans into England and their settling there, and they're marrying there, and they're mixing with English people. Anything like that is very good. Anything like that is very good. But they should have thought of it long before. This, what I consider, this invasion of England by non-Aryans, and this awful damage to the Aryan race in England, is in reality, in my eyes, a sort of divine punishment for England raising her hand against Adolf Hitler. That's what a country gets when it turns against Adolf Hitler and against his people. Unfortunately, his own people are having the same trouble with the Gastarbeiter. I wouldn't mind so much if the Gastarbeiter in Germany were only North Italians, say. Lombards are Aryans. Or if they were real good Greeks. Well, all Greeks are not real good. Some Greeks are mixed, like some Italians are mixed. Southern Europeans, in most countries of Southern Europe, you get people that are not perfectly worthy of marrying Northern Europeans, Aryans. But you have a number of Turks among the Gastarbeiter. And that's the trouble. Turks and whatnot, I mean, say, anything you can imagine. Anything you can imagine. I wouldn't be astonished if you have not North Africans. There are so many in France. I don't know if they are invading Germany also, but France has about 2 millions or 3 millions of North Africans. Berbers and Arabs. Well, of course, these people have been breeding very heavily since the occupation of their country by the French. In 1830, they were not so numerous, and they never needed to go outside the frontiers of North Africa, of Algiers. Now they are, I think they are 10 times more numerous, or 15 times more numerous than they were in 1830. And they need space. Well, instead of invading their neighbors, they invade the former protecting country, you call it what you like. And they marry French girls. Well, it's the fault of the French girls, it's not the fault of the Arabs. If the French girls are not so natural, I mean, say, if they haven't got the sense of a tigress who will not mate with another species, unless she's poor thing is forced to, or a lioness. They have tried that experiment in the zoo of Vienna. Before the war, the zookeepers were, well, everybody had a job in Austria, or the Greater Reich was generally a member of the party. After the war, it seems, they dismissed all the zookeepers that had been Nazis. But fancy that, as though they were going to make Nazi propaganda among the animals. The animals don't need it. The animals are naturally Nazis, at least the higher animals, the big cats, the felines. And they took into their heads to do an experiment, and they put an unfortunate lioness with a tiger. Well, the poor tiger didn't want the lioness, and the lioness didn't want the tiger, but what could they do? They are animals. Men can't keep control of their instincts. Many men cannot. Well, speak of big felines. And they made it, and the product was a feline. They called that a tigre. Well, if I say a human being has not the sense that a tigress has, that is to say, willfully goes with a person of another race, it's not the fault of the person of the other race, it's the fault of the women. I disprove strongly of these women, these French women, that go about with North Africans or anything else, any other non-Aryan, And of the English women, well, in Cheltenham. Cheltenham, I mean, say that small place in the west of England, so southwest of England, where I went before going to the Cotswolds camp, I met two perambulators with half Negro babies in them. In a small town like that, let alone London. How do those things happen? How do these women come to do these things? That's what puzzles me. And if they do, well, they are not worthy to belong to the Aryan race. They should be dismissed. I would, if I were the dictator of England, I'd send them to work in some place where they have need of workers. Instead of putting a foreign worker, I would put them after sterilizing them. Because it's no good mating them with an Aryan afterwards. I suppose you know that the people that breed race dogs, say Alsatians or something like that, if an Alsatian bitch has been with a mongrel dog, they do not mate her with an Alsatian again. So if you impregnate it once, it's sufficient. She's no longer useful for the breeding purposes. They might keep her if they like her, of course. I don't see why they shouldn't keep her. Poor dog, why kill her? No, certainly not. I'm not for killing her. But they don't mate her again. They don't have her mated again. And now, what should I speak of now?
Madker.
Ah, Madker. I like Madker. I admire him. He's a very worthy successor of Rockwell, and he has, well, it's not his fault, not Rockwell's fault, of course, but he has an advantage over Rockwell. He's a German. And that, in my eyes, is an advantage. I wish I'd become a German one day myself, if there is such a thing as reincarnation. I don't know whether I'd like to be a German or not, but at first sight, I'd like to. On the other side, I don't know if I would like to be a German if I had to put up with the discipline in a German family. Supposing my father was an anti-Nazi, it can happen in Germany, you know. Supposing my father was an anti-Nazi and gave me slaps and kicked me about because of my ideas. That could happen. I wouldn't like it to happen. I'd rather be, say, something else, but a Nordic race, of course. To speak of Matt Kern, I like his articles. I read his articles in White Power. I like White Power immensely. I think it's one of the best papers that comes out in the USA. And I find that whatever he says is perfectly logical. Another thing, he never speaks of himself. He speaks of the ideology, and his book, the book he wrote, is very good. Very, very good, really. I have nothing to say except one thing. I'd like to meet him. I've never met him. I'd like to meet him very much. And I think he's most efficient. And let me see. I believe there's one thing I don't like in the movements of America. They are too many. They are too many. I don't like this idea of small national socialist groups that exist only because somebody wants to be at the head of them. I'd like them to all meditate on the example of Streicher. Julius Streicher, the one of the Nuremberg martyrs who said, "Hi Hitler," at the front of the gallows, with his last words. His words before that being, "One day the Bolsheviks will treat you as you are treating us. Now, Hi Hitler." And he went up. And well, this man, Julius Streicher, had a party of his own. He was the head of a, well, I would say, National Socialist Party, party with the same ideas, when Adolf Hitler was rising. But he felt that Adolf Hitler was the man, and he was worth more than he was, than Streicher was. Streicher was sincere and disinterested. And disinterested attitude is the attitude for a national socialist. What did Stryker do? He went to his followers and told them, the party is dissolved. I am dissolved. There's no more party of ours. You go and join the NSDAP. I'm joining the NSDAP myself. Hitler is our hero. You're an old boy. And he dismissed his own people and told them to join the other party, the growing party of the future. Well, why don't these small leaders, those who are conscious, at least, of the efficiency of McCurl, why don't they tell their followers to join the NSWPP? There's another thing I feel rather shaky about, and I felt that already under Rockwell. It's the insistence in some of the literature supposed to be National Socialist from the USA of insisting on the idea of Christian and white. When I hear even the title of McCurl's organization, National Socialist White People's Party, well, if I were a Jewess, I would join it. I would infiltrate it. I would try to destroy it from inside if I were Jewish. And I would get in because I'm white. Isn't it so? It's a funny thing to see that more Jews have not thought about it. Well, good for us if they're not so clever as they were once. If they were going down, good for us. But white is not necessarily Aryan. The Arabs are white. Real Arab, not mixed with Negro. But so many Arabs are mixed with Negro because they have harems and they like a variety of females. Unfortunately, variety of females makes variety of offspring. But those who are pure Arab are white. Berbers are white. Berbers are Mediterranean people. They were in North Africa before the Arabs came. Jews are white. Jews are Semites. They are the first cousins of the Arabs. They might be enemies, but they are first cousins racially, or should be. The Assyrians, the Akkadians, all these people of Mesopotamia and of North Mesopotamia, of the Upper Euphrates, in the antiquity, they were white. Hittites were white. I don't know how far the Hittites were Aryan, or had Aryan mixture among them, I don't know. Their language may be Aryan, but it doesn't mean to say that they were. Many people speak an Aryan language. Well, Negroes speak English today. And who doesn't? That doesn't mean to say they are Englishmen. Anyhow, white does not mean Aryan. The trouble is that in the USA today, the situation is such that the people's consciousness, simple people's consciousness, is white and black. If you say white, they understand. They wouldn't understand the word Aryan half of them. But it's dangerous because Jews are white. And they are much more dangerous than Negroes. Clever Jews, much more dangerous than Negroes. Negroes are. Children, they not leave the Negroes to themselves. Absolutely to themselves without any foreign influence. And they're not dangerous at all. Except that they breed fast. Put them in another surrounding, put them in a surrounding, another place. And don't give them any development aid. That's one thing I mean. This aid to the undeveloped. That should be stopped completely. Completely. And even more, I would say, I'm not for all this aid even to the developed. For instance, these societies, we have a number of societies, they were already existing in the days I was in France as a stopgap teacher. We had propaganda, such and such a society for, what do you call them, backward children. Backward children, sick people, etc., etc., supporting, giving money for them to be pushed along, to be not so undeveloped. Even the whites, even the Aryans, an Aryan that's not really up to the mark, it's deficient. He shouldn't be encouraged and encouraged to read at that. I'm all for the steps Adolf Hitler took, wanted to take. He didn't take them, in fact. He couldn't take them, really, because the church was against them. Church could have been around, especially the Archbishop of Münster, von Galen. Von Galen used to preach against them in his pulpit, against his measures he wanted to take. These people should not be encouraged to live, because you cannot get a real strong Aryan society if you have these people in it, and if they breed. If they don't breed, all right. If you have a weak person that doesn't breed, it doesn't make any difference. But don't allow them to breed. Anyhow, that's one thing. White instead of Aryan. Another thing is that mixture of Aryan and I've had very good propaganda sent to me from an organization called the Sword of Christ in America, asking for the liberation of Rudolf Hess, nothing better, but telling us that all that from the so-called Christian point of view. I wrote to them, I told them what I thought of it, and they replied, telling me that the Jews, the Israelites of antiquity, were originally Aryan. I know that's a theory. It doesn't come from them. It comes from a man called Saint-Yves d'Albert, a Frenchman that wrote a book some century, 100 years ago, that got a queer theory. He also mixes up Jewish words and Sanskrit words. They look like each other, therefore they come from Sanskrit. They don't come from Sanskrit at all. It's just like so many stuff. So much stuff you read of old missionaries in India telling you, well, Hinduism comes from Judaism. What? Very easy. One of the gods of Hinduism is Brahma. Brahma is Abraham. His wife is Saraswati. Saraswati is Sarah. All right. They put two words together and it's finished. There's no grammatical connection between Brahma and Abraham. Absolutely none. But still they put one where there is none. And Saint-Yves d'Albert did exactly the same to support his theory that the ancient Israelites were Aryans. They were not Aryans at all. They were Semites and always were Semites. They may be mixed with Aryans now. And that is one of the reasons of their efficiency. When they mix with Aryans, especially with an Aryan, when an Aryan marries a Jew, the child is a Jew. The child is a Jew from his mother, not from his father. If an Aryan marries a Jew, the child is a Jew, according to Jewish law. And he gets some of the characteristics, some of the virtues of the Aryan race, along with some of the characteristics of the Jews. He might get the efficiency in trade from his father and some sort of idealism, disinterested idealism from his mother, and then he's doubly dangerous. That's what I have to say, but who else do you want to hear? The future, my idea of the future is this. Either one lives in the eternal present and knows the future, doesn't see it as we see it through reason, but just is conscious of it. You have examples in history. Well, let's see the two last, great master and one of his followers, the Templar Knights, who were burnt alive, some say on the 11th, some say on the 18th. Of March 1314. It is said that the great master in the flames spoke and said, I call you to God's tribunal, you both of you, the Pope, Clement V, within a month, and the King, Philip the Fair, within this year. And it was true. They both died. The Pope died on the 9th of April, and the King died on the 29th of November of the same year. How did that man know it? It was perfectly true. How did he know it? How did, long before him, how did Confucius know about modern China? Confucius was asked by his disciples, they say, how long will your doctrine rule China? And he said, 25 centuries, exactly. After 25 centuries, exactly, Mao Zedong, with Mao Zedong, the rule of Confucius, the rule of the spirit of Confucius, was put to an end. A Chinese does not any longer live for his ancestors, and in respect to his father and mother, he lives for the thoughts of Mao and application of the thoughts of Mao. So it was, he was right. How was he right? How did he know it? Why didn't he make a mistake about these two or three centuries? He didn't. He didn't. He, if he was on the margin, it was a margin of 50 years. This is knowing the future. Unfortunately, I have not that capacity. I don't live in the eternal present. To live into the eternal present, you have to be much higher than I. Probably the Führer lived in the eternal present. Because he knew when he was 16, according to the book of Kubitschek, Adolf Hitler, mein Jugendfreund. He knew when he was 16 that he would rise and fall. Like Rienzi, he told Kubitschek when he was coming out of the show, Rienzi, in Linz, one evening. But very few people do live in that way. For those who don't, well, the future is a matter of reasoning, conjecture. Suppose this, suppose that. From the data of the present and from the data of the past, you do some comparisons and you try to deduct the future. But this is nonsense. Nobody can deduct the future from the present or the past. At least the far future, the near future, and in small things of every day. Supposing it is known that in the locality there is a shop that shuts on Monday. Well, I'm perfectly sure, practically sure, that if I go on Thursday, I'll find it open. That's very easy, that's the future, but it's a very near future and very paltry kind of matter. But to tell you whether there's going to be a war before the end of this century or not, nobody knows. Because any event in the future depends on many factors. And the most obvious factors are not always the most important. Not always the most important. There's a very great speech, or rather sermon, of the Bishop of Meaux, the Sui, who is known as one of those who spoke the most beautiful French. He's given to children of college boys and girls to read for his French. And he used to give sermons on the death of great people. There is one famous sermon of his on the death of Henrietta of England, who had married the brother of the King of France, Louis XIV, Louis XIV. And she lived in Cromwell's day. And there's a passage of that sermon about Cromwell and about the trouble he had. He died of stone, what do you call it? Stone in the, not in the bladder, but in the tube that goes down from the bladder to the lower parts of the body. I don't know what the tube is called. In French it's called urethra. Well, Bossuet says, a stone, a tiny little stone. If it had been anywhere else, in Cromwell's body, it wouldn't have made any difference. But it happened to be just in that tube. And he died. Now, how, of course, the death of Cromwell was something important in English history. And it was not foretellable. You couldn't say 20 years before. Who knows? knows what will happen to such person or this person or that person. From a tiny little cause like this, a physiological cause. And that goes for the future. If Roosevelt had died 20 years earlier, he could have died. Nobody knows. Life and death are in the hands of forces that we don't know anything about. World history would have been different. World history would have been different. They say political assassination is generally useless because of some other man. One wants to suppress a movement. The movement is represented by a man. One kills that man. Some other man appears. It depends. Political assassination is generally useless because it comes too late. It always comes too late. To know that this man is dangerous is the cause of his assassination. If somebody, knowing the future, had known that when the man was a baby and killed the baby, history would have been different. Imagine supposing somebody had killed Stalin when he was 6. The history would have been different. Or anybody else, any great man. You know the great man too late, and you get rid of him too late. You should have the insight. The insight, you have to live in the eternal present, and that's not the affair of most people. But if you lived in the eternal present and could know that this man is going to be dangerous for this purpose, and you want that purpose, you want that thing, you love that ideology or whatever you like, that state of things, you want to get the man out, get him out when he's a child, before he begins to start, before he knows himself what he's going to do. That's what I want to say about the future. So I cannot say anything about the future, I just don't know it. I'm not living in the eternal present, all I know is this. Do everyone else what we can now. The future is made of many factors. One of the factors is now. And whatever one does, counts. Whatever one says, counts. Whatever one thinks, counts perhaps even more. I actually believe that thought is a force. Thought is something that comes from our nerves. It's a sort of radiating. It's a radiating force. It's waves, if you like. They're waves of thought. We emit waves. These waves have an effect. Very small effect, of course. Smaller or bigger, according to the person. But it has an effect. I would say, why don't you try to do one thing? Get together every day or every 2 days or every week or twice a week at the same place and especially at the same time. Time is very important. And intensely think. Don't do anything else. Intensely think about what you would like to happen. You have to think all the same. All the people united in one place have to think the same thing. Intensely think what you want the future to be. Intensely think of, say, something simple. How to change the status of the USA or of Canada or of North America. How to do it? Think that. Say the superior forces of the universe help us to do this or that. To bring out the responsible people for the mess in which the Aryan race is now in. And how to get out. I think that is useful. Now, one thing also, I think we have to walk in the footsteps of the Führer in many ways, in all ways, in fact. And there are certain things going on, especially in Canada. I cannot end the speech without saying that. It's something that hurt me so much and still makes me shudder every time I think of it. We should follow this.